Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Possessed of an unnatural and legendary hunger, the Reapers have come to Earth to establish a new order built on the harvesting of enslaved human souls. They rule the planet. They thrive on the scent of fear. And if it is night, as sure as darkness, they will come.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth. Narrated by Ken Jackson. Performed by Tim Getman, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Thomas Penning, Katie Foster, Jonathan Watkins, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, Christopher Graybill, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Peter Stray, Nanette Savard, Johan Detweiler, Laura Quinn Anderson, Chris Rowan, Greg Reinfeld, Mort Shelby. Vampire Earth, Book 1, Way of the Wolf, Part 1.
Northern Louisiana, March, the 43rd year of the Kurian Order. The green expanse, once known as the Kasachi Forest, slowly digests the works of man. A forest in name only, it is a jungle of wet heat and dead air, a fetid overflowing of swamps, bayous, and backwaters. The canopy of interwoven cypress branches shrouded in Spanish moss creates a gloom so thick that twilight rules even at midday. In the muted light, collapsing houses subside every which way as roadside stops decay in vine-choked isolation, waiting for traffic that will not return. A long file of people is moving among moss-covered trunks. At the front and rear of the column are men and women in buckskin, their faces tanned to the same weather-beaten color as their leather garments. They carry sheathed rifles, and all are ready to use their weapons at the first hint of danger. The guns are for the defense of five clusters of families clad in ill-fitting lemon-colored overalls at the center of the file. Patches of brighter color under the arms and along the inner thighs suggest the garments once glowed a vivid optic yellow and are now faded from heavy use. A string of five pack mules follows behind them under the guidance of teenage versions of the older warriors. At the head of the column, well behind a pair of silent scouts, a young man scans the trail. He still has some of the awkward gangliness of youth, but his dark eyes hold a canny depth. His shoulder-length black hair, tightly tied at the back of his head, shines like a raven's feathers even in the half-light. With his dusky skin and buckskin garb, he could be mistaken for a native resident of this area 3 centuries before, perhaps the son of some wandering French trapper and a Choctaw maiden. His long-fingered hands wander across his heavy belt, from holstered pistol to binoculars, touching the haft of his broad-bladed parang before moving on to the canteens at his waist. A scratched and battered compass case dangles from a black nylon cord around his neck, and a stout leather map tube bumps his back from its slung position. Unlike his men, he is hatless. He turns now and again to check the positions of his soldiers and to examine the faces of his yellow-clad dependents, as if gauging how much distance is left in their weary bodies. But his restless eyes do not remain off the trail for long.
If they come, they'll come tonight.
Lieutenant David Valentine returned to that thought again as the sun vanished below the horizon. He had hoped to get his charges farther north of the old interstate before nightfall, but progress had slowed on this, their fourth day out from Red River Crossing. He and his wolves shielded 27 men, women, and children who had hazarded the run to freedom. The families were now adapted to the rigors of the trail and followed orders well. But they came from a world where disobedience meant death, so that trait was understandable.
They'll come tonight.
If they had been traveling by themselves, the detachment of wolves would already be in the Free Territory. But Valentine was responsible for seeing the Red River farmhands brought safely north. 4 hours ago, the yellow-clad group had crossed the final barrier, the road and rail line connecting Dallas with the Mississippi at Vicksburg. Then Valentine had pushed them another 2 miles. Now they had little left to give. It was hard for Valentine to quiet his mind with so much to think about on his first independent command in the Kurian Zone. And quieting his mind, keeping life sign down, was literally a question of life and death with night coming on. Being a wolf was as much a matter of mental as physical discipline, for the Reapers sensed the activity of human minds, especially when fearful and tense. Every wolf had a method of subsuming consciousness into a simpler, almost feral form. But burdened with new responsibilities and with night swallowing the forest, Valentine struggled against the worries that shot up like poisonous weeds in his mind. The Reapers read life sign better at night. His charges were giving off enough to be read for miles, even in the depths of the Kisatchie. If his wolves' minds were added to the total, the Reapers would home in on it, like moths drawn to a bonfire. A call from ahead broke into his anxieties. Valentine raised his arm, halting the column. Garnett, one of his scouts, gestured to him.
Water, sir, in that little holler. Looks safe enough.
Valentine spoke loudly enough for the column to hear.
Good. We'll rest there for an hour, no more. We're still too close to the road to camp.
The faces of the farm families brightened, in contrast to the deepening night, as they drank from the spring trickling down the side of a shallow ravine. Some removed shoes and rubbed aching feet. Valentine unscrewed the cap on his plastic canteen, waiting until the families and his men had a chance to drink. Wolves dived for cover behind trees and fallen logs. The yellow-clad families, who lacked the ability to hear the baying, shrank together in alarm at the sudden movement. Sergeant Patel, Valentine's senior non-commissioned officer, appeared at his elbow.
Dogs? Very bad luck, sir. Or...
Silence! Sergeant, who knows this area best?
Patel's eyes did not leave the woods to the south.
Maybe Lugger, sir, or the scouts. Lugger pulled a lot of patrols in this area. I think her people lived west ways.
Would you get her, please?
Patel pointed to and brought up Lugger, a seasoned veteran whose limber, sparse frame belied her name. She held her rifle in hands with alabaster knuckles.
Sir?
Lugger, we may have to do some shooting soon.
Valentine spoke in an undertone, trying not to alarm the unsettled civilians.
Where's a good spot for it?
Her eyes wandered skyward in thought.
There's an old barn we used to use on patrol, west of here, more like northwest, I reckon. Concrete foundation and the loft's in good shape.
How long to get there?
Under an hour, sir, even with them.
Lugger jerked her chin toward the huddled families. Their yellow overalls now looked bluish in the darkness. Valentine nodded encouragement.
Solid foundation and a big water trough. We used to keep it filled with a rain catcher.
No help in that direction. Mallow's more to the east, but it'll have to do.
Mallow, the senior lieutenant of Zulu Company, had remained in the borderlands with a cache of supplies to help them make it the rest of the way to the Ozark Free Territory. Valentine considered something else.
Think you could find the rendezvous at night?
God willing, sir.
Take a spare canteen and run. Ask Mallow to come with everything he can.
Yes, sir. But I don't need my gun to keep me company. I think you'll need every bullet you got before morning.
Lugger unslung her rifle. Valentine nodded.
Let's not waste time. Tell Patel where to go, then run for our lives.
Lugger handed her rifle to the senior aspirant, spoke briefly to Patel and the scouts, then disappeared into the darkness. Valentine listened with hard ears to her fading footfalls as fast as his beating heart.
Please, Mallow, for God's sake, forget about the supplies and come quick.
As his men dusted the area around the spring with crushed red pepper, Valentine approached the frightened families.
They found us?
The speaker was Fred Bruggen, the patriarch of the group. Valentine smiled into their dirty, tired faces.
We heard something behind us. Could be they cut our trail. Could be a dog got the wrong end of a skunk. But as I said, we have to play it safe and move to a better place to sleep. Sorry to cut the halt short.
The refugees winced and tightened their mouths at the news, but did not complain. Complainers disappeared in the night in the Kurian zone.
Good news is that we're really close to a place we can rest and get a hot meal or two. Personally, I'm getting sick of cornbread and jerky.
He squatted down to the kids' level and forced some extra enthusiasm into his voice.
Who wants hotcakes for breakfast tomorrow morning?
The kids lit up like fireflies, nodding with renewed energy.
Okay, then. Everybody take one more drink of water, and let's go.
Valentine filled his canteen, forcing himself to go through the motions nonchalantly. The aspirants somehow got the pack mules moving, and the column trudged forward into the darkness. With curses matching the number of stumbles brought on by confusion and fatigue in the night, the column continued north. Valentine led the way. A rope around his waist stretched back to Sergeant Patel at the tail end of the file. He bade the families to hold on to it to keep everyone together in the dark. One scout guided him, and a second brought up the rear in close contact with two fire teams shepherding the column's tail, their phosphorus candles ready. If the enemy was close enough for their dogs to be heard, the Reapers could be upon them at any moment. Valentine resigned himself to the orders he would give if they were set upon in the open. He would abandon his charges and flee north. Even a few wolves were more valuable to the Free Territory than a couple of dozen farmers. Valentine, continuing on that grim line of thought, decided that if he were a battle-hardened veteran from the campfire stories, he would stake the farmers out like goats to a prowling tiger, then ambush whatever took the bait. The death of the defenseless goat was worth getting the tiger. Those win-at-all-costs leaders from the old world history books would never be swayed by sleepy voices repeatedly asking, "Is it much farther, Mama?" Valentine hurried the column over his shoulder.
Close up and move on! Close up and move on!
Wolves picked up tired children, carrying them as easily as they bore their weapons. They found the farm exactly as Lugger had described. Her wolf's eye for terrain and detailed memory of places and paths would astound anyone who did not know the cast. The barn was a little bigger than Valentine would have liked, with only 22 guns. No time to be picky, not with Reapers on our trail, he thought. Any place with the trees cleared away and walls would have to do. Garnett entered with blade unsheathed, covered by his comrades' hunting bows and rifles. The parang, a shortened machete used by the wolves, gleamed in the mist-shrouded moonlight. A few bats fluttered out, disturbed from their pursuit of insects among the rafters. The scout appeared at the loft door and waved the rest in. Valentine led the others inside, fighting a disquieting feeling that something was wrong. Perhaps his Indian blood perceived something tickling below his conscious threshold. He had spent enough time on the borders of the Kurian zone to know that his sixth sense was worth paying attention to, though hard to qualify. The danger was too near, somehow, but ill-defined. He finally dismissed it as the product of overwrought nerves. Valentine inspected the sturdy old barn. The water trough was full, which was good, and there were shaded lanterns and oil, which was better. Patel posted the men to the doors and windows. Cracks in the walls of the time-ravaged structure made handy loopholes. The exhausted families threw themselves down in a high-walled inner corner. Valentine trotted to the hayloft ladder and began to climb. The barn's upper level smelled like bat urine. From the loft, he watched his second scout, Gonzalez, backing into the barn, rifle pointed into the darkness. Garnett reported from his perch at the upper door.
Gonzo's got wind of him, sir. He always gets bug-eyed when they're around.
Three wolves from downstairs joined them in the loft and took positions on each side of the barn. Valentine glanced down through a gap in the loft floor to the lower level, where Patel talked quietly to Gonzalez in the dim light of a screened lantern. Both glanced up into the loft. Gonzalez nodded and climbed the ladder.
Sir, Sarge wanted me to show you this.
He extended a filthy and stinking piece of cloth drawn from his pocket.
Ugh.
It was an anxious young man who hurried to the Padres that evening along familiar paths, carrying a burlap bag full of leftovers, an old empty pistol, and a head full of choices. The faces and animals at the public tent, the shores, hills, and trees, all pulled at him with promises of safety and security. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. Valentine went into the backyard, checked on the animals, and began to chop wood. Turning cordwood into kindling always cleared his mind, even if it left his body wet and rubbery. He had been doing this chore for the Padre and for a number of the neighbors in trade for sugar or flour since his arrival 5 years ago. The solid feel of the axe in his hands, the thwack as the blade sank into the dried wood, absorbed the things that bubbled up from the dark corners of his mind. He stacked the splintered results of his labor and went inside the house. Valentine found the three men sprawled in the smoke-filled library around an empty bottle and a mostly empty jug. A small bag of letters, including a couple from a young lady named Gaffley, sat on the Padre's nicked-up table, and a much larger bundle of letters lay tucked in one of the men's satchels, ready for the long return trip south. The one called Finner paged raptly through a battered volume titled Classic Nudes Through the Photographer's Lens.
Ah, David, you missed some boring catching up and some even more boring drinking.
He didn't bother rising from his barely upholstered chair.
Did you win the race?
Sort of. Doesn't matter.
He told the story, ending with his being disqualified.
Sheesh. I'm with you, Jess.
I'd like to hear how you knew my father, Mr. Samuels.
Samuels looked at the Padre.
It's always Paul when I'm off my feet, son. When I was a kid, about your age, give or take, your dad and I used to come up together from down south, just like me and Jess do now. We like to keep in touch with the folks up here in this old fraud. Well-lubricated philosophy sessions, you might say.
Valentine began distributing the bounty from the public tent. The men dug in with the enthusiasm of days spent on the road, eating only what the wilderness provided.
You fight them, right? The Kurians, the Reapers, the things they make? And the patrols, right?
Patrols are what we call the Quislings up here nowadays.
Well, not all at once, son. In fact, we spend more time running scared from them than we do standing and fighting. We can hit them here and there where we don't stand too much of a chance of getting hit back. When we're not doing that, we're trying to keep from starving. Ever drunk water out of a hoof print to wash down a couple handfuls of ground-up ants? Slept outside in the rain without even a tent? Worn the same shirt for a month straight? Really stinks, son. And I don't just mean the shirt.
Valentine stood as tall as he could, trying to add a couple of inches to his 6'1".
I'd like to join up, sir.
I knew you could talk him into it.
A week later, Father Max saw the party off on a warm, sun-dappled morning. He gave David an old, musty-smelling hammock. It had uses other than rest. The Padre showed him how to roll his spare clothing up in it, then tie it across his back. By the time that was finished, other recruits who had collected over the past days began to shoulder their own burdens. Most carried backpacks bulging with preserved food. Valentine found that there were mouthfuls of words to be said and no time or privacy to say them.
God be with you, David.
The graying old man's eyes were wet with tears.
All right. Don't worry about me. Jacob Christensen said he'd help out around here. He wants to teach the younger kids, too, so you don't have to...
The Padre held out his gnarled hand for a handshake.
Yes, David, I'll be fine. Soon you'll have more important things to worry about than getting the cow milked and the chickens fed. But the day I quit teaching the kids their ABCs is the day I'll be resting in the ground.
Samuels and Finner also shook hands with the Padre. How the men looked so alert was beyond Valentine. They seemed to be up every night drinking and talking, then visiting the trading wagons and surrounding homes in the day. David guided them, leading them on backwoods paths to the households that matched the names on the mail. One visit stood out when Samuels had called on an old woman to deliver a few personal effects from her dead son, who had been a friend of Samuels. That night, there had been more drinking and less laughter in the library. Valentine began to learn on the first day of the journey south. He learned just how sore his legs could get. Though he had walked all day many times in his life, he had never done so with better than 40 pounds of food, water, and possessions on his back, at a pace set by a demanding sergeant. Other volunteers joined the group as they walked. One whom he knew, Gabriella Cho, had gone to the Padres' school for a number of years. Her rich black hair had fascinated Valentine as he struggled through the awkward rites of puberty. Necessities at home kept her out of school past the age of 15. She had blossomed into a woman since Valentine had last seen her 2 years ago.
Gabby! So you're coming too?
He was relieved to be finally taller than the doe-eyed young woman. She looked at him once, twice.
Davy? Yeah, I'm taking the big trip.
We missed you. Father Max had to start asking the rest of us the tough questions. It wasn't the same since you left.
No, nothing's been the same since then.
When she replied to further questions with one-word answers and downcast eyes, Valentine ended the conversation. They spent the first evening at an overgrown crossroads more than a dozen miles south of the Padres. They made camp and spent the next day talking, waiting, and nursing sore muscles. Another soldier showed up, escorting four more recruits. Two of the men were twin brothers, 6'6" blonde giants. Valentine was surprised to learn their names were Kyle and Pete, rather than Thor and Odin. They repeated the process as they hiked south and west in easy stages. Easy, that was, in the estimation of the men who bore the title Wolves. To Valentine, each day proved more exhausting than the last. By the time they reached the outskirts of Minneapolis, the group had swelled to 30 soldiers and over 100 young men and women. Lieutenant Skellen met them at a boat they used to cross the Mississippi. The lieutenant wore an eye patch so wide it could just as well have been labeled an eye scarf, which mostly covered a crescent-shaped scar on the left side of his face. He had dozens more recruits with him. Like the sergeants, they were in their teens, or barely out of them, wide-eyed and homesick among new landscapes and unfamiliar faces. The travelers made a wide loop west around the Twin Cities into empty lands teeming with prairie plants. One day, they skirted a 100-head herd of mountains of hair and hide, and the wolves informed Valentine he was looking at his first buffalo.
Ain't no weather can kill those big shaggies.
Finner nodded knowingly at his charges from the boundary waters.
The cows and wild horses gotta find low wooded spots when the snow's blowing out here, but them buffalo just form a big circle and wait it out.
Valentine picked up much more on that journey south. He learned that he could make a compass by stropping an old double-edged razor blade against the back of his hand. Charged with static electricity, he suspended it from a string in a preserve jar to shield it from the wind. The little piece of metal found north after wavering indecisively like a bird dog sniffing the breeze. The recruits learned how and where to build a fire, using reflectors made of piled logs to hide the flame and direct the heat back toward the camper. He was taught about trench fires in high wind, and to always roast game skewered on a spit beside a fire, not over it, with a pan underneath to catch every drop of the valuable fat. They learned how to make flour, not only from wheat, but also with the flower heads at the end of cattails, and even with bark. Valentine pounded masses of bark in a pan of water, removed the fibers, and allowed it to settle, then poured off the water and toasted the pulpy starch on a stick. Even with salt, it did not taste like much, but he found himself able to eat just about anything as the long weeks of walking wore on. Even more incredibly, he gained weight, though he was hungry from dawn to dusk. When their packs emptied, they didn't always have to live off the land. They stopped at isolated farmhouses and tiny hidden enclaves where the residents fed them, passing out bags of beans and corn flour to the 100-odd campers resting in their fields. Valentine practiced with his pistol. The wolves passed a hat around and collected 24 bullets from the men with handguns that used the same ammunition as his. Some of the wolves carried up to 3 sidearms in order to have a better chance at using bullets acquired from scavenging the deceased after a fight. Valentine plinked away at old paint cans and weathered paint-stripped road signs. It was during one of these marksmanship sessions in an old barn near camp that Valentine made an effort to talk to Sergeant Samuels. He had just knocked down a row of three aluminum cans, their colored labels illegible with the passage of years, and he was feeling pretty full of himself.
You should try it with your left hand.
That cleaned the self-satisfied smile from Valentine's face in a hurry.
Why, Sergeant?
What if your right arm's busted, kid? What if someone just blew your hand off? I know most instructors say it's a waste of time. Me? I think it's good to use your offhand. Makes your brain and body work different than it's used to.
Valentine set one of the cans back up, the sharp cordite smell tickling his nostrils. Feeling awkward, he raised the gun to eye level, feet shoulder-width apart. He sent the can flying with the second shot.
May I?
Valentine passed him the gun. The sergeant examined it professionally.
This was your dad's?
No, Sergeant. I suppose he's a neighbor. He gave it to me.
Gun like this? It's in great shape. He must have thought a lot of you.
He handed the gun back to Valentine.
More like he thought a lot of my parents.
He paused for a moment, not sure how to phrase the question.
You seem to think a lot of my father, too. I never knew about his life before he met my mother. He just said he traveled.
Samuels glanced out the missing barn doors. The campsite was nearly empty. A heavy patrol was out under the lieutenant, and most of the recruits were taking advantage of the afternoon off to wash clothes and bathe in the nearby river.
Yeah, David, I knew him. Not from way back, from before the skies filled with ash, that is. We met in Michigan, soon after all this shit started. I was younger than you then, maybe 15. Your dad and I were in this outfit. We called ourselves the Band. Fighting sometimes, hiding mostly. Cops, army guys, we had some Coast Guard sailors from Lake Michigan even. The uniform was a hat with a piece of camouflage material sewn on it somewhere. God, what a hungry, sorry-looking bunch we were. Even when we were blasting away at the grogs, we couldn't really believe it. It was like something out of a sci-fi movie. No one knew shit about what was going on. I used to cry every damn night, it seemed to me. My parents were in Detroit when the nuke went off, you see. I learned one thing. Tears make you feel better, but they don't change anything. You'll still be hungry when they dry up, still be lonely.
The two men, one mature and weathered, the other a few years past puberty, wandered out of the barn and watched the sun descend into the western haze. Samuels nodded to a couple of the wolves carrying out camp duties. Then he sat down on the corpse of an old green tractor. The space where the engine once sat gaped, an open wound with wires dangling.
So you were both wolves then?
Valentine omitted the sir, since they were both sitting.
No, that came later. God, we didn't know what to think.
At the watchtower over the main gate, three farmers gulped at the roasted hickory nut drink called coffee, for lack of a more accurate term. Valentine asked them for their best guess about which direction the harpies were last seen flying, and got three slightly different answers. The consensus seemed to be a little north of east. Most of the town still worked to keep the blaze from spreading. The exception was the Helm family. The father retrieved his son's body, while Mrs. Helm sat on the steps of her porch with her arms around her other two children, dully watching the flames consume the great barn. Valentine climbed down from the watchtower. Bourne and the other eight reservists waited by the militia stable tack shed. Recently turned earth next to the little wooden shack exposed two stout cases. Bourne gingerly examined the contents of one of the open cases.
How is it, Tank?
Still usable. We turned it this summer when we blasted the new drainage ditch from town. Quickest way I know of to get rid of tree stumps.
If I promise not to ask where you got it, will you spare us some of that bang?
Valentine knew the dynamite had probably been lifted from a Southern Command supply cave, perhaps with the aid of a small bribe to the resident quartermaster.
If it means paying the harpies back in their own coin, I'll tie up a couple of five-stick bundles and have them fused before you can say nitroglycerin. Part that worries me, though, kid, is you wanting to take off right now. Wandering around in the dark with a hood around, looking for something you aren't sure where it is, well, It's like playing blind man's bluff in a room full of buzzsaws.
Valentine squatted down and looked at the dynamite.
I want to hit them while they think we're still busy with this fire.
Yeah, I buy that. One thing you got going for you, anywhere these things are holed up, it's sure to smell like a well full of dead skunks. They shit as much as pigeons, and you up everything proportional. I know they eat like crazy, and their handlers aren't too particular about what they feed them.
Valentine's entire team volunteered for the duty, but in the end, he took two. He asked two others to borrow horses and ride for the nearest command post. The rest would guard against further attack in case the Harpies came back to finish the job. Valentine just prayed the Reaper didn't decide to come back. Valentine took Gil Delvecchio and Steve Oren with him. Steve Oren, a brassy young man who enjoyed hunting, had ventured many times into the borderlands east of Weening in search of game. Oren had the best knowledge of the land and excellent eyes. He'd once explored as far as the St. Francis River, which marked the belt of uninhabited land surrounding the Ozark Free Territory. Gil was a powerfully built farm boy from the Missouri Valley in the Dakotas. He exuded strength and could be relied on to keep his head in a fix. Delvecchio had been one of the two men to climb the silo. His sweaty skin was still stained with soot. The three forced down a quick meal as they loaded up 2 days' supplies in rucksacks. With weapons, ammunition, dynamite, and almost no camp gear, they could move quickly even in rough terrain. Valentine brought his pistol, with 6 bullets left in the magazine, and the best compass and map Bourne could provide. They hiked out the main gate a few minutes after midnight, turning down an offer by the other helm boy to go along as their guide. Valentine told him he would help his family more by fighting the fire that threatened their house. He mentally added that while the killing machine that took his brother was probably elsewhere by now, perhaps striking again in the confusion of another harpy attack, there were too many other risks in the eastern dark for Valentine to chance losing both of a mother's sons the same night. The Reaper was much on Valentine's mind as the three men moved east. Oren picked the trail. Valentine followed several paces behind, making sure he stayed on course, and Delvecchio walked just behind, rifle ready for instant use. The hood obviously worked with the Harpies, but would it decide Cho was a valuable prize to be taken for questioning? Her nondescript uniform differed little from any other impoverished residents, and she carried no weapon. Perhaps she was grabbed as a weak target that could not put up much of a fight to be consumed at a later time. Valentine prayed Cho had lost consciousness from pain and shock. He could not bear the thought of his closest friend being carried east to a dreadful end, screaming out her pain the whole way. By 3 a.m, the men reached the wide St. Francis River. A few ruined buildings that had been reclaimed by the wilderness more or less stood on its hilly banks. Valentine looked into the skull-like emptiness of a brick house, the interior nothing but humps of collapsed roof and saplings, and thought of the world that was. 50 years ago, little cabin cruisers and fishing boats must have floated up and down the river, its banks under control and sandbars dredged. But with man occupied elsewhere, nature had reclaimed her own. At a rest halt, he began to despair of their hunt. The Harpies could be anywhere.
Val, there's a light on the river.
The three climbed a little promontory and looked north at the distant speck of light. It was near the western bank of the 100-yard-wide river, but whether it came from boat or shore could not be seen at this distance. Who would be fool enough to burn a light right at the border? A guide for the returning flyers? Valentine was suddenly hopeful. They decided to check it out. Valentine and Oren readied their rifles and picked their way north, keeping under cover. When they got close enough to see that the light in fact came from a boat, they rested for a few minutes before creeping forward again. Oren had the best night vision of the three and therefore used the binoculars.
It's a small barge and a towboat.
They lay in a little hollow, peeking at the river from behind a fallen tree.
Looks like 5 men visible on the towboat. One's got a gun. No one's on the barge. Its riding light must be practically empty. The light is on the barge, electric, not a lantern.
The towboat was attached to a ruined concrete piling, projecting out of the lake, perhaps the last remnant of a dock. Oren leveled the binoculars at the barge.
They got it anchored at the front and the back. If anyone's in it, they're staying hid.
A gust of wind off the river made the men wrinkle their noses. They exchanged glances.
Oh, shit. I think we found the nest.
They hashed out a plan. Valentine would take a bundle of dynamite and swim to the ship from the north end of the barge. When he set it off, the other two men would start sniping at the tugboat, with hope that it would be lit by the burning barge and use the other bundle of dynamite on it from the shore. Gil said he was sure he could throw the bundle the 30 feet from the shore to the boat. Delvecchio pulled a hand axe from his belt. The weapon was light and handy, more of a fighting tomahawk than a tool.
Thanks. We'll meet back here. If you're being chased, just go west and wait for me.
Hope you don't puke easy if you're gonna get close up to that thing.
Let's not waste any time. I want to get this over before dawn. Maybe that hood sleeps in the barge.
Valentine stole past the lounging figures on the tug. If five men were up and around at this hour, perhaps 10 more might be crammed below. Or were they out, somehow helping the harpies? Once he had the bulk of the barge between him and the towboat, Valentine crawled through vegetation to the water. The dynamite, matches, and his pistol rested on his back in a pack that might keep the water out for a moment or two if he was lucky. Valentine kicked off his shoes and crawled into the cold water. It reminded him of his bath and how Cho had dried him off afterwards. He took the comforting wood handle of the tomahawk in his hand and half floated through the water toward the barge, moving like an alligator with just eyes and nostrils out of the water, the pack making a sea monster hump on his back. He felt as alive and alert as if he had just finished a light breakfast after a long night's sleep, rather than having been awake for 18 hours. It was a good thing he hadn't eaten recently. When he slithered close enough to really smell the barge, a horrible musky odor mixed with a sharper, turpentine-like smell assaulted his nostrils. The hazy moonlight revealed details of the ancient barge, a mass of rust and paint and makeshift welds, with M33 painted on its side in 3-foot-high letters. Valentine shifted the tomahawk to his mouth, holding it between his teeth with straining jaws and breaststroked into the river. He made for the stern anchor line. The gentle current assisted him with its chilly flow. He reached the cable, grateful for its hand-filling thickness. The deck of the barge was as beat up as its sides. It had a single hatch open to the sky. The battery-powered lamp, a conglomeration of what looked like a car battery and a truck headlight, pointed up into the night, but seemed to bathe the whole top of the barge with an intimidating, revealing light. Valentine wished he had told Orin and Delvecchio to start firing when they saw him reach the barge. He could use something to draw the men's attention to shore. Still dangling, he gently placed the hatchet on the deck of the barge. Now or never. He hoisted himself up on deck and crawled for the hatch. Expecting a shout at any second, Valentine peered into the reeking hole. He could make out little in the dark, but there seemed to be floor 6 feet or so down. He rolled over the edge and landed barefoot in sticky filth, axe ready. The hold stank like a slaughterhouse, and he had to fight down his gorge as he stood up in a cramped little area. A gutter ran the length of the deck, filled with excrement. The hollow interior was empty. No. As his eyes adjusted, Valentine realized that a panting shape leaned against one wall. It was a harpy, wrapped up in its own wings, as though in a leathery cocoon. A trickle of blood pooled beneath its rump, wounded, maybe dying. The debris on the floor included a melange of bones. A cluster of human skulls decorated a metal pillar, part of the barge's rusting structure holding up the deck. The heads looked like a yellowish bunch of coconuts. There was a door forward out of the hold. A body lay at the bottom of stairs descending from the door. Pale, naked, and headless. But it was nevertheless familiar. Valentine had found Cho. An awful kind of warmth filled his stomach. He no longer minded the reek. He could make out slit nostrils and a toothy, pointed jaw decorated with bristling, cat-like whiskers protruding from the tent of folded wings. Wet drool dripped out with its rapid, shallow breathing. Valentine raised the small axe The thing never knew what happened. Valentine leaped on top of it, bringing the blood and brain-soaked tomahawk down again and again. Flecks of blood splattered his snarling features. A familiar flapping sound came from the hatch, and the light reflected from the deck lamp was obscured by a winged shadow. Valentine crossed the hold to the forward stairs to the door, keeping clear of the hatch. He could sit there, light the dynamite, and blow a few harpies to kingdom come. Shots echoed from outside. Delvecchio and Oren must have panicked at the returning harpies and tried to prevent them from re-entering the barge. Valentine somehow ignored Cho's body, took his pistol, and tossed the backpack onto the stairs. A harpy flopped into the hold, one wing injured.
Welcome home, fucker!
The harpy's scream brought answering shrieks from outside. Valentine knew he was drawing all kinds of ugly from the skies, as well as the tugboat, but he wanted Cho's body to have a lot of company feeding the crayfish and gars. The tugboat crew must have a support weapon mounted on deck. Valentine prayed that Delvecchio and Oren were smart enough to pull out now and head west. Valentine pounded on the roof of the hold.
Dinner! Dinner, come and get it!
The wounded harpy pulled itself toward him, gremlin mouth open in vicious anticipation. Other flappers dropped into the hold. Valentine took two steps backwards toward the door and found a bundle of dynamite and tin of matches. Grabbing a bunch of matches, he struck them against the rough side of the stairwell, illuminating the dank little closet space. Valentine lit the fuse, dropped the matches to the floor, and picked up his pistol. He fired a shot into the vague shapes collecting in the hold. He then placed the hissing dynamite on the first stair and pushed at the hatch. Locked. He bashed at the hatch with his shoulder, closing his eyes to the expected oblivion that would blow him into bloody fragments, but the rusted lock gave way. He threw the door open and dashed onto the deck. Then dived for the water on the riverside of the barge. He felt a bullet pluck at him as it passed through his shirt at the armpit. Valentine was underwater when the explosion hit. The boom sounded muted, but its force thumped at him even through the cushioning protection of the river, knocking the breath from his body. The shattered rear half of the barge upended as pieces of its hull splashed into the river all around. The towboat was a mass of flame, the machine gun silent. The harpies, incendiary bombs, must have been on the towboat's deck in readiness for another attack. Valentine got his bearings and submerged again, swimming for shore. No doubt a few very unhappy harpies still circled above. His fingers struck the river bottom. As his brain cleared, he realized that he was unarmed. His pistol was at the bottom of the St. Francis, dropped when the concussion from the explosion racked him, and the tomahawk was also probably landing somewhere in the Mississippi. He gathered himself and ran out of the water and onto the riverbank. Picking up a river-smoothed rock in each hand, Valentine hurried under the protective overhang of the trees. He felt defenseless as a rabbit with raptors circling above, but made it to the little hollow without trouble. What was left of the tugboat was floating downstream in flames. An answering warble came out of the darkness. The pair joined him. Oren returned Valentine's rifle.
Quite a show, Val.
Delvecchio put the other bundle of dynamite back in his pack. Bourne could use it on more tree stumps or trade it for corrugated tin to build a new barn. It felt good for Valentine to have a rifle in his hands instead of rocks.
Oren, you need a break. I'll take point on the way back. You can keep us on course, and Gil, you cover.
The Yazoo Delta. Summer of the 41st year of the Kurian Order. The wet crescent between the Mississippi and Yazoo rivers is one of the most uncomfortable pockets on the globe. The swamp and canebrake delta returned to its original waterlogged existence by the breaking of man's levees on the Father of Waters, is virtually empty of human habitation. The Yazoo's flow moves imperceptibly through the bayous, making it impossible to tell if a current exists at all among the soggy sloughs. The water is so choked by vegetation, it seems like earth, and the earth among the tangled roots of cypress, willow, and water oak is spongy and hard to separate from the water. From water beetle to cougar, the teeming wildlife lives an amphibian existence among the Spanish moss and cattail thickets. It is a patch of humid desolation, taking its name from an Indian word for death. This empty land is a fine training area for the young wolves of the Ozark Free Territory. From the Yazoo Delta, they can keep an eye on Mississippi River traffic and explore outside its football-shaped 188-mile length into the burned-out shells of Memphis in the north and Jackson in the south. It is the most impenetrable and least guarded of all the empty borders of Southern Command, and the handful of wolves in the Delta keep on the move, often going an entire season without supply or communication from the territory. David Valentine traveled here as a newly invoked wolf and learned the hunter's arts under two unremitting teachers, Nature and a longtime cat named Everready. In Nature, Valentine learned to apply the lessons of his winter on how to find food, water, shelter, and fire, what might be called the four primary elements of human existence. From Everready, a man who accepted no rank in Southern Command because it would mean an end to his one-man war against the Kurians as well as his jealously guarded independence, he learned how to unify his judgment, senses, skills, and tools into a single weapon. The young wolves under Everready's tutelage practiced their art, improvising weapons to hunt everything from submerged alligators to treed raccoons. They took not only nourishment from their kills, but also hide, bone, and sinew for use in making clothing and tools. A few of the more atavistic-minded fashioned lucky charms from their trophies. Everready, owner of perhaps the longest necklace of reaper fangs in the Old South, encouraged the practice. What Everready taught even better was the art of concealing life sign. His apprentices spent more time learning mental discipline than they did physical, mastering a form of self-hypnosis that cloaked their auras against the inhuman searching powers of the Reapers. Their skill at this determined whether they would hunt the enemy or be hunted like the game they brought home to camp. The camp used a pair of ancient water oaks as its roof. The stumpier of the two oaks suffered a curious deformity. The main trunk ended 12 feet up and branched into six limbs that curved out of the trunk first sideways and then upward, resembling a cupped palm with too many fingers. The wolves had rigged a patchwork of tents into these branches, making an area beneath that stayed dry as long as the wind kept down. Wind would have been welcome in the humid air of the swamp, where runoff came to die. There was an air of death, decay, and corruption to the flooded Yazoo Delta that no graveyard could match. Mists and fogs haunted the neophyte wolves, and mysterious wildlife voices croaked and hooted and gibbered from the bulrushes. Even their camp resembled an abattoir, with their packs and water bottles hung from the low branches like trophies or a gamekeeper's gibbet.
Ugh.
Valentine sweltered in his cocoon of mosquito netting in a shallow sleep brought on by heat exhaustion. His usually pleasant hammock had been transformed into a torture chamber by the temperature and humidity. Naturally, he preferred to keep himself, like his clothing and his pack, off the ground and out of reach of the various multi-legged crawlies and snakes that might be attracted to a warm, motionless body on the damp earth. Only the earliest hours of the morning brought a lessening of the heat. Valentine would give anything he owned for a swim in one of Minnesota's clear, cool lakes in this Delta summer. But even if he had been physically comfortable, he would still have passed a fitful night. The old dream about his family home had come back. Everready's pre-dawn return cut off his old nightmare. The cat had walked off to the east within an hour of picking the spot for their camp days ago, leaving orders to wait and not to use guns while hunting. Everready declined to explain whether this was because of nearby danger or just the parsimony brought on by visiting a supply station only twice a year.
Everybody up!
Everready labored into camp with a heavy sack across his shoulder. His ancient M1 carbine was slung across his chest, stock glowing with its usual loving polish of well-oiled wood. Burton, who had the third watch, started to pour water into the coffee pot.
Forget that for now, Bert. You boys aren't going to want breakfast when you see what I brought home. Ha! Hand me that water, boy.
Valentine tried to rub the gum from his eyes as he watched Ever-Ready drink. Though the black-skinned man was a cat, one of the caste whose members operated alone deep in Kurian-conquered territory, there was nothing cat-like about him. Ever-Ready was a grizzled old warthog, all tough-minded determination on a thick body beneath a thicker hide.
Good.
Barefoot, with ragged black trousers that ended at calves as wide as horse hooves, the rest of his body resembled a barrel with arms added as an afterthought. Chest muscles strained from an equally ragged vest cut from the heavy cloth that the Reapers wore, and his neck was festooned with dangling teeth pulled from the hoods he'd exterminated. The wolves had never seen him eat anything but oversalted game stews and apples. Valentine believed Ever-Ready knew the location of every single apple tree and grove within a 300-mile arc of the Yazoo Delta, and this eccentric diet had left him with ageless vitality and shining white teeth. He was as bald as the man in the moon, but hid the fact with a battered baseball cap with a Saints logo. Ever-Ready could climb like an ape, float like an alligator, and leap like a deer, all without making enough noise to cause a mouse to startle. Easing himself out of the hammock, Valentine shook his head and took a pull from the water bottle he bedded down with to save a trip out of the mosquito netting. He pulled on his moccasins after eyeing the insides. Though they had hung from his hammock, the ingenuity of the Yazoo wildlife at curling up for a nap where least expected had been brought home to Valentine by a painful centipede bite earlier in the summer.
What'd you bring us, Santa?
The wolves gathered, and Ever-Ready dumped the stained sack in the center of the campground. At first, Valentine thought it was a trick of the rapidly growing light, but the sack seemed to writhe as it hit ground.
Valentine, get your chopper.
Valentine retrieved his parang, a 14-inch broad hunting knife swelled at the center like a pregnant machete. It had a heavy wood handle with the tang capped at the end, combining the sharpness of a skinning knife with the utility of a hatchet. Ever-Ready used his own smaller clasp knife to cut open the bag, which Valentine saw with a kind of cold horror really was squirming on its own in the center of the ring of five men. The big cat dumped the sack's contents.
Fuck me!
Burton started and pulled at the beard he'd been growing all summer. Flopping in the dawn was a pale humanoid torso. Where arms and legs should have been, only tarry stumps remained. A second sack, fixed by cording, circled around the neck and hid the thing's face. The sweet, corruptive odor made the wolves take a step back. 16-year-old Hernandez, the youngest of the new wolves, crossed himself.
Never seen one this close, boys?
The four shook their heads, disgusted and fascinated at the same time.
There are these big hunting cats in a place on the other side of the world, boys. India was called. Big, stripy arms things called tigers. You wouldn't think they could sneak up on anything, unless you saw them moving through tall grass on our televisions, that is. But a mama tiger would teach her baby to kill by swatting something so it was half dead. Then the cub would kill it. Now, that ain't exactly what I'm doing with you cubs. But I want you to get a good look at a hood up close, minus his robes, in such a way that you'll live through the seeing of it. Sort of a National Geographic courtesy of old Ever-Ready.
The thing rolled on its back.
Bastard can't talk too good.
Ever-Ready reached into his forage pouch.
I yanked this out.
The cat handed over the Reaper's limp, 16-inch long tongue, and the wolves passed it around dubiously. It reminded Valentine of a snake, scaly with a beak-like point at the end.
That's the straw that sticks into you. See the scales? They come up in you like barbs, keep you from pulling away. Not that you have much chance if this honey's got you in his arms.
How did you bag it?
I was scouting a little railroad town southeast of Big Am's ruins, Holly Springs. Sources told me this fella came into town about midnight, doing the usual checkup with a company of Quislings out of Corinth. Anytime a Reaper comes through, a few folks try to leave town real quick. And this thing goes after him when it was getting on toward dawn. The Quislings were too busy in the hen houses and pig pens to notice much. A hungry Reaper is hard enough to keep up with, and maybe they didn't want to be around when he fed. So these refugees are heading for Tall Timbers on horseback, and the Yellow Eye here is after them. He got one just as the sun came up, dead, and I caught up with him when he got all dopey from the drinking. It was a pretty bright morning for a change, so his eyes weren't working too well either. I emptied old Trudy into him from about 10 feet.
Everready patted his carbine affectionately.
Shot a leg more or less off where it was showing under the robe, and took the rest off with my cavalry saber before he knew what hit him. I hacked around his throat and pulled his tongue out from beneath the jaw, Colombian necktie style. Sacked him up, then caught up with the horse belonging to the poor bastard he caught. Then I broke my ass getting west. I wouldn't care to be the Quisling commander at Hollis Springs. The big boss in Corinth will send some hoods out to settle things with me and them both.
Uh-huh, you covered some miles. Where's the horse? Rode to death? We could have traded it at least.
Everready shook his head.
There was some border trash camped out by a creek a few miles northeast of here. I gave the horse her head, just took the saddle and bridle off, and she scented the other horses and wandered off. I carried the saddles a ways, but it was too much lugging the ghoul and all that leather, too.
Hard on the group by the crick if the Reapers catch up with that horse.
They ain't no friends of yours, son. That's why I've been warning you boys about these borderlands. No law and order. There's the bad order of the Kurian spaces and the law of the free territory. In fact, you'd be surprised at how orderly some of these Kurian towns are. Everybody with identity cards and permission slips and papers just to go to the outhouse. But between them, where we are is up for grabs. And these bastards will rob you and leave you for dead as soon as they'd say good morning. I figure any hood pursuit is welcome to them. Now, let's get down to business. Give me your slaying blade, Valentine. Now watch this.
Everready lectured as if he were in a classroom with glossy black experiment tables instead of a patch of soggy ground 40 miles from nowhere. He opened a vertical cut along the thing's stomach.
See how that black goo comes up when the air hits it? It's something in these things' blood that makes an instant suture. If you ever get any on your hands, get it off quick. And whatever you do, don't get it in your mouth. Put some of this stuff on a dog's tongue and they'll kill the man holding the leash. It's not so bad, though. Even when you're hacking one up, the goo doesn't fly around that much. It's too sticky. Make sure you pull your blade out quickly, though. If you leave it in for a few seconds even, this stuff will sometimes glue it right in place. Take my word for it. You don't want that to happen.
Captain Lahav's steady green eyes evaluated Valentine from his pulled back hair to his stained knee-high moccasins, fingers drumming against his thigh. The company commander wore the look of a busy man who accepted only efficiency. The captain and Valentine both stood in the sole leak-free room in the Old Harbor clubhouse. Its dark paneling hinted at a previous existence as either an office or a small library. Two comfortable armchairs and a table, piled above and below with a honeycomb of plastic milk crates, almost filled the warm little room. Black and white photographs, most bearing the marks of poor film stock, hung in rough frames. Lahav flaunted the swarthy good looks and heavy mustache of a romance novel pirate or ruthless western outlaw. His athletic build, spoiled slightly by the hint of a paunch, set off his forest green buckskins, so dark they looked almost black in the dim light of the windowless office. Offering Valentine a warm handshake in the worse-for-weather main entrance to the clubhouse, Lahav invited his new wolf to the records room. Both men sank into the armchairs with the appreciation of the rarity of such comfort.
You might call this our cave.
Lahav waved casually toward the laden table.
These papers are the closest thing we have to a headquarters. The milk crates just make moving easier. The rest I leave to the clerk. Coffee, tea, beer?
A beer would be very welcome, sir. It's been a long summer.
Lahav rose from the chair without using his arms, almost a levitating trick.
I'll bring two cool ones from the basement.
Valentine looked around at the pictures, wondering about a man who would treat a wet-behind-the-ears recruit like an honored guest. In less than a minute, a breathless brown-skinned girl, 7 or 8 years of rubber band energy and frizzy hair, bounced into the room with a clasp-stoppered bottle. Lahav followed the little dynamo.
Meet David, Jill. David hails all the way from the land of 10,000 lakes. Which state is that, Tadpole?
Minnesota!
She smiled proudly as she handed over the bottled beer.
Hi, David. Did you swim in those lakes?
Some of them. Why, do you like swimming?
Does she like swimming? I check her feet whenever I can to make sure they aren't growing flippers, don't I, Tadpole?
Uncle Adam!
David came on a horse. Can you take him to the corral? He looks like he needs a brushing.
Can do. Nice to have made your acquaintance, David.
Acquaintance.
Valentine offered her his hand.
Likewise, I'm sure.
Acquaintance.
She solemnly returned the handshake and stepped backwards out the door.
That's Jill Poole. Her father was a lieutenant of mine. He died in a fight about 3 years ago. I look in on her mom whenever we're in the area. She runs a nice little boarding house right by the river. Fine woman. She keeps a firm hand on the boatmen who stay. It's not quite a marriage, but I think of Jill as my daughter. She's fearless around the men. Most of them remember Poole and they indulge her. She loves making beadwork. Most of the Wolves and Zulu Company have a bracelet or something of hers. To the people we're fighting for.
Prosit.